Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And welcome to the NXT TakeOver In Your House review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by one of the Dudley Boys, Michael Sidgwick from What Culture, here to review everything that happened on last night's NXT TakeOver In Your House pay-per-view. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review Raw, SmackDown and NXT, but also AEW Dynamite and, of course, pay-per-views. We have interviews, roundtable discussions and a roundup of the week, complete with a bloody good quiz, of course, on wrestling culture. As I said, though, joined by Michael Sidgwick to review TakeOver In Your House. What do you think of the show, Sidge?
Well, I didn't particularly like it. Our esteemed colleague, Michael Hamflett, is off today enjoying some personal time. So the usual balance of guy who's pretty much done with the presentation of this type of wrestling versus the person who still really wants to believe that has potential to be good is a little bit askew. However, he did tweet, for those who don't follow him, and you should follow him, at Michael Hamflett. He said the following, 7 hours ago. Glad to see lots of people really enjoyed NXT TakeOver. Always enjoy seeing genuine enthusiasm and good faith discussion on the TL. I thought it was absolutely boring as from start to finish, and the CWC needs bulldozing the second they're back out on the road. I thought it was a little bit better than that. I guess, you know, he would probably say if he were here and present, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but there were certain things I think very few of them, I might add, were undeniably good. Some of the work, some of the athleticism, for example. But I'm echoing that opinion. I'm thinking this is the worst TakeOver literally ever. They are match quality wise, if we're going to be really nerdy and really pragmatic about it, there were probably some TakeOvers in the early run that weren't as good as some of the action, for example, that you saw in that main event. And yet, feelings-wise, which is what's meant to be important, the atmosphere is always far more incredible. I understand circumstances are different. But the feeling, the atmosphere, everything overawed this TakeOver. So realistically, I think this is the worst TakeOver of all time. There were very few moments where I felt, oh, I'm watching a TakeOver here, and this is really awesome. Like, it just felt like not a TakeOver. It just really didn't. What do you think? Because you're the high guy, Wilborn, and I'm interested in someone who's not very numb to this.
Yeah, first of all, I think the crowd were absolutely dreadful for this show. And I think you can't just turn around and say, oh, it's because it was kind of crap. Because it wasn't crap. Like, they were just dead. For how much they were banging on about all the people they packed into the CWC, it was akin to what they normally have, in my opinion. It was surreal, that, first and foremost. And I thought this show was fine, which is really damning it with faint praise, in terms of the fact of, you know, this wasn't a bad show, in my opinion. It was a show that I will probably not go back and watch any of the matches of, which is the worst thing you can say about a TakeOver, really. Like, yeah, I don't think it was anything to write home about. I cannot wait, as Hamflett alluded to, and you will no doubt talk about more, for them to just get back to classic TakeOvers. But that's also not really the fault of you know, anything. It's restrictions, etc., etc. there were still bits that I enjoyed during this show, and there was nothing that I was sat there akin to watching a main roster WWE pay-per-view where I'm like, oh my God, this needs to end right now. There was some intrigue, I was annoyed at some results, but that's probably going to feed more into the storylines. So that's probably the right decision, if you can probably work out what I'm alluding to with that one. The main event, you sort of knew where it was going quite early on, but I did have quite a bit of fun with it. But I did have to put it one side, and no doubt we'll talk about this, the age-old rule that applies to multi-man matches of just like, well, I guess they're just laying on the outside right now. Aside from Cross, it wasn't really like they had anything that took someone out of the match permanently. It was all just like, right, get rid of Cross, and then we'll just do a spot with you two or you three or whatever it may be. But the spots were quite enjoyable, even if I could sort of see, like I say, where the whole thing was going early on in that match. But let's dive straight into it. Let's talk about the matches. Because the opener, unsurprisingly, was quite enjoyable because look at the guys involved in it. MSK, Bronson Reed, and Legado del Fantasma, that being Santos Escobar, Raul Mendoza, and Joaquin Wilde. And the story of this match, everyone's afraid of Bronson Reed, which, yeah, look at him. That makes sense. And it was quite fun. It was really enjoyable the way it was sold of, you know, Escobar wanting to face anyone except Reed, despite the fact he wants to take his title off him, and him tagging in. I think, you know, Raul Mendoza and Joaquin Wilde have really surprised us over the last few months in terms of they're no longer just sort of, well, not that they were really, but we assumed they were just going to be sort of the crap heavies of this stable, and they've been so much more than that. But their facials here are just like, you know, their boss is going, right, get in there and beat him up. And they're like, him? I don't want to face him. I want to face the tag team champions. That's the wall I'm here for. But yeah, the story of that early on in the match was, I mean, they tried everything and they could barely knock him off his feet if they were lucky. I did like the bit with, I think it was Nash Carter, moonsault to the floor. Wilde takes Carter out on the floor with a dive. So then both Mendoza and Lee take a dive out to the floor, and Bronson Reed, of all people, takes everyone, friend and foe, out on the outside. Eventually, Legado del Fantasma take control. They get a two count off for a top rope hurricanrana from Escobar. 450 from Wilde. That gets a two count as well. Then Reed comes back in and runs Wilde. Hits a double Samoan drop on Wilde and Mendoza, which was great. Escobar comes in, hits a Michinoku driver. Carter, though, just gets in to break it up. And then they do that high-low from Wilde and Mendoza on Carter. And Wesley has to get in. And I didn't really bite on any of the near falls because, I mean, you and I talked about this, and Hamlet and I talked about it on the preview for the show. We went into this thinking, well, that title's not going to change hands. That title's not going to change hands. And neither is that one. And so it was difficult even for me to think, oh, maybe this is going to be it. And in the end, we were quite right. The bit with Escobar, he goes to the outside, he gets the North American Championship, he fires up, and then he just gets smashed. But this time, Reed doesn't sandwich him against the barricade. He runs through it, basically, destroys it. They clatter through it, it explodes, and they're just dead out there on the floor. And that means that it's now MSK versus the rest of Legado del Fantasma, and we know what happens there. Mendoza gets hit with a super kick, assisted blockbuster, and then Reed comes back in. He's recovered. Takes down the straps. Tsunami! 1, 2, 3. The winners take all, but they came in with the titles to begin with. What do you reckon to the opener, Sige?
Right. I'm going to say the nice thing first, because I don't want it to get buried, which it probably will do in my analysis. Like, I thought this was a good to very good match.
Yeah.
I almost felt sorry for it in a strange way. I think the whole layout was designed to be more fun than it was great and exhilarating and dramatic, like on purpose. Mm. I legitimately thought watching this, oh, it's a shame that the crowd are reacting in a really subdued manner, because this match was built purely like for the hollow, oh, this is awesome. NXT's almost back to its former self, at least physically, in terms of the fan layout. There wasn't the difference between Full Sail and this setup of the Capital Wrestling Center. They weren't remotely dissimilar. Mm. Similar amount of fans. Some of them had masks on and they were behind a plexiglass. But like the amount of people there wasn't remotely dissimilar to what it would have been in a normal Full Sail. And we know how loud that can be. maybe the people there were just understandably tentative about going back, but you know, they're from Florida, so I can buy that for a second. I'm just spitballing. yeah, really subdued. I think the match was laid out to the point where it wasn't particularly elegant in how they were trying to get the dives in. There was one sequence where one person from Legado would perform a dive, stand there, celebrate with the idea of the second one's coming, and it was like subverted each and every time, and all built to Bronson Reed doing his dive. I thought, you know what, that is basically a house show spot, because they looked ridiculous not expecting to eat a dive, but that's fine. It was just boom, 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 dive, 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 excuse. The Simone drop was an impressive physical feat, but again, the wires were so obvious, like he essentially draped himself over Bronson Reed's shoulders. Like, and at one point I saw a rest hold get applied at 12 minutes. I'm thinking, don't do that. At the 12-minute mark in a match of this genre, I should be apoplectic in excitement. I should be having a conniption fit. I should be popping like a daft little mark and quite get that feeling. But yeah, I thought they thought, you know what, fans are back. We're going to have loads of fun with this at the expense of everything making perfect sense or everyone looking like they want to win. But come on, fans are back. Let's have some fun. I think this would have cleared the four-star barrier if that atmosphere received the layout, but I just got this weird dissonance and I got it on you.
Yeah, I can't get over that crowd. Considering, you know, very different scenarios, but the way things are like Mania and Double or Nothing were received, it's like, takeover, guys, come on. And like, this was the perfect opener for that, but for whatever reason, just didn't come across in terms of crowd reaction. We cut backstage for a storyline that we'll get to at the conclusion of this podcast. Cool Cal O'Reilly's there and he's saying it's a good day for a fight. And then he gets heckled by Johnny Gargano and the rest of the way. A brawl breaks out. There's quite a few of these on the show because bloody hell, William Regal just can't get this show under control. But we'll talk about that at the end because this is what it's all leading to. Put Todd Pettengill on TV forever. He did a segment backstage trying to load a VHS tape to show us the build for Xia Li versus Mercedes Martinez and gets told, no, it's just tell the truck to play the clip. Like, you don't have to rewind a tape and put it on long play or anything like that. I love him. And I sense, you know, Hamflet really enjoyed that. And there's been noises made by him regarding more appearances in NXT. And I certainly would not be against it. What do you reckon to Todd Pettengill, Sig?
I've got a lot of nostalgic affection for Todd Pettengill, an unabashed dork. And honestly, given what this company has become in the years and years and years and years and years and years since he was a full-time regular, like, it's just an injection of wholesome energy. I don't necessarily think it's the best strategic move to have someone of his particular disposition all over the show for a long, long time. But I don't know how much difference he would make if he was like a full-time backstage interviewer or whatever. Someone of his, like, someone who does his job isn't going to affect the quality of the show. The commentators do, and God damn it, we will get to them, but I'm going to save my show-long disdain for this commentary team in terms of the personnel and the tone that they are instructed to talk within for one specific match, but it was an all my problem. God damn it.
Yeah, I suppose there's the only thing I would say with the whole Todd Pettengill thing. I loved it. Like you say, it does nothing to harm the show whatsoever. And whether it be, I don't know, maybe it's a bit convoluted to have him have a segment each week or like an interview segment or whatever it may be. But yeah, it's an occasional recurring appearance would be nice. But as I said those words, I just thought, oh no, actually, it's WWE. Within about 4 weeks, they're going to have someone bully him and make him look like a little bitch. And I just, maybe once. I would love to know what, like, and this is a rarity, the younger viewers of NXT would have thought if they, you know, don't know the wider nostalgia of In Your House and the first thing they see is Doc Hendricks' big face going, take over! I'd love to know, is that guy? But anyway, next up...
people on the internet right now going, guys, God, can you imagine if the IWC was here and Triple H was doing his thing in 2003? It's like, what? So they're going to be mystified. Like Todd Pettengill, honestly, and Doc Hendricks to these people, they might as well be Jim Londos. Like Hackenschmidt.
Yeah.
Gagne. Like they've got any idea. No. About now. So mystified is my answer to your question, Wilbur. Mm.
Xia Li, Mercedes Martinez next, though. I don't know what I expected from this match, but I didn't expect this in terms, just in the terms of the way it played out. So they brawl. Mercedes Martinez is generally getting the upper hand, but Xia Li's just throwing everything she's got at her, really, really, you know, hard-hitting stuff. She pushes Martinez into the ring post shoulder first, but then she injures herself trying to attack. I think she kicked the ring post and injured one of her legs. So that allows Martinez to come back into it. Butterfly suplex, but Lee comes back with an exploder. Martinez dodges a corner attack. She gets a cliffhanger. She gets a two count. Xia Li at this point is getting battered because it's Mercedes Martinez and she's mint. She's so good. So Boa, who's there, has come out with Xia Li. Boa pulls her out of the ring to try and save her and get, allow her to sort of gather herself again. Martinez just comes out and goes, get out of the way. Xia Li goes for her, but she hits a back body drop on the floor. And then in the midst of all this, the distraction, the interference, the shenanigans, whatever you want to call it, Martinez gets back in the ring. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, cyclone kick from Xia Li. She gets the victory, surprise victory in like 7 minutes or something like that. Boa throws Lee a chair after the match, but Martinez kicks out her legs, grabs it off her and batters both of them with it. I really like the way that Boa's getting between the ropes and she just went, nope, like that, and starts nailing Xia Li. And then Mia Ying, the dragon, thousand-year-old thing, she appears back on that throne on the ramp. Martinez stares at her. She offers her out for a fight. She comes down towards her. She gets grabbed by the throat, fights back. But then Mei Ying grabs her by the throat and hoys her off the walkway into the barricade. And that is that, Sige.
Yeah, I've got, of all the matches on the show, I struggle to form any kind of firm opinion on this.
Hmm.
Something about the length, the way it was arranged with the shenanigans and the, it just felt like a TV match.
Yeah, because in terms of like they presented it as like this is Xia Li's big revenge for the Mae Young, and you meant to, it's meant to be, we talked about this on the preview, it's meant to be like not necessarily what she's learned in the interim, but the spooky powers she's developed by this torture she got put through by Tian Sha. And it didn't, it just, yeah, it was like, oh, she fighting through the pain, I suppose. That's an element to it. And then she just nailed her with a cyclone kick and won, and that was that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to think of this. The storytelling was not particularly great. Just developed kind of a my turn, your turn. Like, I just didn't get invested or, like, compelled into watching it at any real point. Some of the individual moments look good. Like, the cyclone kick on the finish looked great, but ultimately, how much does one move matter when you haven't been sort of sucked into the drama like throughout? Just felt a bit spotty, a bit drab. I just felt like weirdly distanced from it. They wanted that thing at the end to be like this huge, holy moment. This mythical ancient being is actually doing something.
Mm.
Like, no one reacted for it.
No.
And that's such an indictment. They've been building the mystique of this smiling, mailing. Sorry, I didn't catch pronunciation, which is itself a problem. They've built the mystique of this character and the anticipation for if she might do something or when she might do something. And as I've said all along, like, unless she's the second coming of like the greatest women's wrestlers of all time, like, it's going to look ridiculous because of how powerful she's meant to be as this presence. And like months and months and months, they've hired animators to do this. They've invested loads of TV time in this. And just it just fell totally flat. No one cared. And I guess it looked halfway cool. But how many times have I seen someone thrown into a barricade? It's not like this dragon's born secret. The dragon told me this is going to really hurt someone. Like, I saw someone get thrust into a barricade in an even better spot, like literally in the match prior.
Exactly, yeah.
or we were talking about, like, do people like this? Is it good? Is it just a long-term storyline? And we forgot, with it being WWE, the base level requirement for what that should, it just didn't work. And you'd think, Jesus Christ, they've put enough into this. All of this fell totally flat for me. And I just can't help but feel like they've wasted their time a lot.
Yeah, you're right about the barricade thing. It was just sort of like, oh, you know, I'm certainly not crying out going, oh, do some spooky stuff with smoke or venom or, you know, whatever it may be. But like you say, just throwing her off the ramp, at least throw her like through the ramp, even if like you're like, hang on, she only lifted her up slightly, but somehow with this supernatural power she's got, she can really generate it on the throw. It was just like, oh, that's that. See you on Tuesday sort of thing. I was like, indifference. And that's not what I want to feel, because I've really enjoyed this Xia Li character and this whole Tian Sha stable. So yeah, in terms of like sacrificing someone like Mercedes Martinez, although this may continue, of course, it felt like a bit of a waste, because we always say, I mean, she's never going to do great things in NXT in terms of being allowed to. Obviously, wrestling-wise, she's great. But she's old in the eyes of WWE, and therefore that's the role she has to play, unfortunately. But yeah, even so, the name like Mercedes Martinez, it felt like, did you really need her for that? Like, in terms of, like you say, if the story was, oh my God, she's got this death kick that comes out of nowhere. It's like, well, could have a face anyone to demonstrate that sort of thing. And I know they have already, but
yeah, that's the issue. Like, they've done your rank and file. And if you look at the investment they've placed in this character, you can only do that for so long before it just goes totally flat. The idea now is they want a respectable, respected senior presence to act as a bridge to that main event scene. And on this evidence from Xia Li, I think it's in ring. And in terms of how seriously it's being taken, it's a massive step below that absolutely like huge highs that we've seen from the NXT women's division over the years.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Before the $1 million championship ladder match, we got a quick promo from Tommaso Ciampa and Timothy Thatcher. I love these two now. They just shouted a lot and said, in 48 hours, they're going to show everyone how dangerous they are. And then they got a lovely vignette from Ted DiBiase discussing the legacy of this $1 million title. He comes out, he's got this glass briefcase with the title in, and he sits down at ringside to enjoy these two men fight out for daddy's attention, I suppose. Similar sort of story you see in a lot of ladder matches to start this off. I mean, Grimes was great with the taunting and stuff and the early wrestling sequences, but you know, two-man ladder matches, we've seen a lot of them over the last year or so. They fight, they keep trying to grab ladders and get them in. There's a pull and push and twatting people with ladders, etc., etc. Eventually, Grimes nails Knight out on the outside with a ladder and throws him into the barricade. But then Knight reverses it and does the exact same with him and just starts battering Grimes all around ringside. They fight back. They've set up in the midst of all this, lots of different ladders for spots. Grimes counters one of LA Knight's moves with a German suplex into a ladder, tries to hit him with another ladder or, you know, haul him into another one. But Knight moves out of the way and hits a neck breaker onto a propped up ladder. Oh, that looked like it sucked for both men. Knight leans another one up against the ropes. He puts one on the top turnbuckle. But Grimes, of course, reverses Knight, and Knight eats what he's just set up face first into that ladder propped up on the turnbuckle. Grimes looks like he's in control, but then Knight, of course, pulls Grimes's hair, sends him into the mat. And then Grimes counters Knight by sending him in a back body drop into a ladder. Eventually, Knight gets hoied over the top rope onto that ladder bridge that they often have between the ring and the barricade. And Grimes yells about going to get the gold ladder. He goes and grabs it, brings it into the ring, gets up there. Knight catches him, though. Knight's recovered. They fight at the top. They both fall off. They go down, double down. Eventually, they are brawling on the outside. Knight whips Grimes into a ladder, which he just climbs. Then Knight pushes the ladder away, but Grimes climbs onto that scaffolding that they often have at ringside and jumps off with a crossbody. Grimes looks like he's going to get in there and climb up that gold ladder, but Knight gets in there, tries to powerbomb him. Grimes, Hurricane Rana, shouts, "To the moon!" Nearly just gets his hands on the championship, but Knight pushes the ladder over and Grimes crashes onto another ladder bridge that's been set up on the ramp. LA Knight climbs up. He unhooks the championship. LA Knight is your new million-dollar man. I was sad with the results, but I can kind of see where they're going with this. How does this rank in terms of recent ladder matches? Because we've had a lot, Sige.
Well, that's the problem. I find it difficult to rank this ladder match because we've experienced such ladder match fatigue that I could see the finish coming like a mile away, like 1 mile away. Like, I watched that exact finish or variation of that finish because I think it was like a stack of four tables, like at Extreme Rules 2008 or One Night Stand 2008 with The Undertaker taking the exact same bump. And it's like 13 years after that now, if my math is correct. Like, you knew that was coming. You saw the back body drop coming. Because the form of these matches has been cannibalized to such death that you feel like resentful for getting bored because they worked their asses off, that endured like loads of like just awful looking punishment. The back body drop weirdly looked tame. I don't know what happened there, if the ladder hadn't been gimmicked properly, but it did not explode in half. It just kind of just splintered a little bit. It still would have sucked to take, and some of the other stuff in this match looked like it absolutely sucked to take. I really enjoyed early doors. Like, there's a childish element, a playfully childish element to this dynamic and the storyline going into it that I quite enjoyed how it was sort of folded into the match when they were sort of like playing tug of war over the ladder. It's like, it was almost verging on what I ultimately wanted from this, which was a comedy ladder match or a comedy match of some kind before it fell into the tropes. Like the bump at the finish, I hate burying it for being unoriginal because it looked awesome and it looked like well committed, but sword coming from a mile away. The fact that Cameron Grimes spent loads of time dithering with his catchphrases and getting a different coloured ladder as if that means anything. It's a baby face. He's just an idiot. And I know that's his character, but it's kind of death for a baby face to be an idiot. You can do this as a heel, but not as a baby face. Like, I've got deep concerns for him going forward. I did like the creativity of when the ladder was going to go against the scaffold, but it turns out he was able to scurry up and do the high spot. Like, any kind of creativity you get in a match like this is welcomed, because as I've just said extensively, my God, the tropes are just there. It's not their fault that NXT in particular have done 1 million ladder matches since October 2019. But at the same time, they've done a million ladder matches since October 2019. I promised a burial of the commentary team, right?
Oh, God.
And I'm going to give it. There's a moment, and it's when Cameron Grimes skins the cat, having Hurricane Ronald Drake over the ropes, LA Knight over the ropes, and he motions that he's going to the moon.
Right.
Mm-hmm. After he'd done the Hurricane Rana, Beth Phoenix screaming, right? And it doesn't work because she's been screaming the whole night, screams, "He's got a second wind!" It hurt my ears, man. Shut up. And then Cameron Grimes goes, "To the moon!" And Vic Joseph, who is, funnily enough, screaming. I think he screams when whoever he lives with says, "Do you want some sugar in your coffee?" "No sugar for me, thanks!" He hasn't said anything in his life that he hasn't shouted Vic Joseph. Cameron Grimes goes, "To the moon!" Vic Joseph goes, "Don't just say it, be it!" And then Beth Phoenix goes, "He is being it with new fervor." What does that mean?
Oh my God, yeah.
Someone desperately, I'm begging you, desperately someone needs to remove the thesaurus and the megaphone from her her person.
Mm.
"He is being it, Vic, with new fervor." No one talks like that. Nobody. I mean, I do sometimes, admittedly, but it's... God, I don't commentate for 2 hours. You know what I mean? Like, I don't shout all the time. Shut up, man. Stop shouting. I can't handle it. I can't handle the shouting. It is absolutely... It's like if I, with my vocabulary and some of my turns and phrases, I can understand why some people think I'm a dick. I hold my hands up. But I'm not shouting them. You know what I mean? Like, shut up, man. Take the megaphone and the thesaurus away from Beth Phoenix. Vic Joseph needs, like, to just be sat down. Right, can you just talk normally for an hour? But that's not what they want them to do. Because NXT has to be the intense action brand. This must be reflected in the commentary. And he is ordered, presumably, because everybody else has done it. Maro was doing it. I just, here's your job description. You ought to scream everything for 2 or sometimes 2.5 hours. Scream it, scream it, scream it. I can't deal with it, man. I can't deal with it.
No, I completely get where you're coming from. I mean, be like saying, "Vic, you know when Stu does the tsunami?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, that's great." Yeah, imagine if he did that for the whole show. Like, Stu gives you some light and shade. He talks about, "Oh, well, I've been involved in ladder matches, but I've never been victorious in them. They really take stuff out of you, et cetera, et cetera." And like you say, it's just, "Oh, my God, he's got a ladder." Yeah, that's kind of the point of a ladder match. And it's 2 minutes in, so don't be getting your hopes up in terms of it being over anytime soon. Yeah.
How has he not lost his voice?
I don't know. It's a very good point. It's a really good
I don't know. Answers on a postcard.
Let's move on because Hit Row, we've got a new song out on the Hit Parade, Michael Sidgwick. It's called Now You Know. They plugged that whilst Todd Pettengill was trying to get some merch plugs in. And then we got Raquel Gonzalez versus Ember Moon. I thought these two worked great together. I'd love to know your thoughts on this. We knew what to expect, really. They've sort of telegraphed it a long time. But the fact that they've established that Moon hits that eclipse, Raquel Gonzalez is in a lot of trouble, and Moon has been scouting the fact that, you know, Gonzalez's strength, her one-arm powerbomb finisher, can also be a weakness. We got that quite early on, in fact, in this match. Raquel Gonzalez went for it, and Moon hit her with a Hurricane Rana, sent her into the turnbuckle. Gonzalez, though, for the most part, dominating early on. Moon went for a diving code breaker and just got caught and hit with a sidewalk slam and a twisting Vader bomb. Moon, though, does fight back. She hits a code red. She gets a submission hold on Gonzalez, and Dakota Kai, who's there at ringside, annoyingly helps Raquel Gonzalez. She pushes the ropes a little bit closer to her so she can get to them and stop the break up the hold. Gonzalez and Dakota Kai, they're there sort of getting their thoughts together on the floor. So out comes Moon. She takes out the champion with a tope suicida, and then she gets a flatliner for a two count as they go back into the ring. That distraction at ringside, though, will eventually cost Ember Moon. She's climbing the ropes. Kai is there, and that allows Gonzalez to grab a superplex And it looks like Gonzalez is taking control. Gets her up for that one-arm powerbomb. This time, Moon reverses into a cradle for a two count. She fights back. She gets a jawbreaker. She hits a diving codebreaker and an eclipse. This is it. 1-2. Dakota Kai grabs Raquel Gonzalez's foot, puts it on the bottom rope, and makes sure the referee is fully aware of that. So finally, a Shotzi Blackheart returns to chase off Dakota Kai. She brawls with her. She sends her into the staging. They fight off backstage, and then Gonzalez is on the apron. Moon climbs the ropes, tornado DDT on the ramp, puts her back in the ring, kick out, goes for another eclipse, but Gonzalez catches her, snake eyes in the corner, and then finally hits that one-arm powerbomb for the victory. Raquel Gonzalez retains the NXT Women's Championship. But what did you think of what they put together here?
It was nicely put together.
Mm.
Thank you for that segue, because it was nicely put together and arranged as a match without like blowing me away or reaching the absolute pinnacle of all-time great women's title matches at TakeOver. But nicely put together is the word I would describe it. I really like how they worked around the choke bomb. Because as you said, it's like a strength and a weakness, because it's convoluted in the setup, and how long it takes to set up is worth it, because it's an absolute death blow that no one can kick out of. But so that explains the psychology of the move. The reason why you take so long to set it up is because it's just an absolute game changer, a game ender. But at the same time, that setup is like a platform to reverse it and to do transitions in the drama. Like, this is possibly the nicest thing I can say about this match, is that it's very much the same, the way they built it, is like the One-Winged Angel and the Rainmaker. Mm. What I love specifically about those two finishes isn't just that they look awesome, isn't just that they've been beautifully established, obviously the One-Winged Angel more so than the Rainmaker, but the mere setup of the move, because it's labored, but with a purpose, is that you can reverse out of it. You can do neat little character moments in the reversal process. Like, my God. I was at the Madison Square Garden ROH Supercard with New Japan. And what I love about a move like this, and I'm going to use the Rainmaker as an example just because it's one of my favorite spots ever, is that you can get your character over while escaping or reversing it. You can do this in character. Like, this is why they're next level. Jay White was about to eat the Rainmaker, but it was far too early, so he just sat down on his ass. And it's like, that is awesome. That's an absolutely awesome spot. Like, people have reversed Poison Ronard, like the One-Winged Angel. Like, people have just elbowed him in the head, like John Moxley. Like, you can reverse these moves in character. So I really thought it was a neat idea to build the match around Ember Moon getting out of it. But it wasn't as good as any Mikado Omega match, put it that way.
Mm.
Well done. Good match. I'll not remember this as a very good one or a great one in the weeks and months to come.
Another comedy segment with Todd Pettengill. He's playing Karate Fighters with Dexter Lumis and just sort of goes, oh, how does the ladies treat you these days? And Dexter Lumis just stops, breaks Pettengill's Karate Fighter in his hand, and Pettengill realizes he's probably overstepped the mark. I don't know how they've turned my opinion around on Dexter Lumis, but I was like, oh, goody, Dexter Lumis is here now. And they're doing it more with, I saw something on Twitter. I think someone highlighted the hug between Dexter Lumis and Poppy from NXT and said, oh, if you actually look, there's like a hover hand or something. It's clearly more of a friendship hug than a relationship hug. And now Indy's there on Twitter going, wait, what? What's this? Just give me Index. Yeah. Fantastic. And then they announced that they're going to have the Great American Bash TV special on Tuesday, the 6th of July, for obvious reasons. That's to look forward to on TV in a few weeks' time. And then we got the main event, NXT Championship. In amongst all this, by the way, they kept cutting backstage and people were just fighting. The story that we'll get to at the conclusion, as I said. Fatal 5-Way, though, Karrion Kross defending the NXT Championship against Cool Kyle O'Reilly, Johnny Gargano, Pete Dunne, and Adam Cole. And, yeah, it was a ridiculous spot fest, this. But, yeah, it was unquestionably, this was more fun than I probably would have had it been even even carrying Cross Johnny Gargano, I think maybe I would have had less fun, because it was just, like I said, in my head, I'm kind of excusing the whole, well, hang on, what's Kyle O'Reilly suffering with that he's out for 5 minutes whilst all these others do spots? But look, it was four men going, right, we have to get rid of this monster and then maybe we can sort it out between the rest of us. It starts off with basically each of them trying to take out Karrion Kross. Cole and O'Reilly brawl to the floor. So it's Kross and Pete Dunne. He kicks him, goes for a guillotine, but Kross just hits him with a Northern Lights suplex. O'Reilly comes in, fights with him, counters into a heel hook. Kross fights out of that. German suplex for you. Gargano comes in, goes for the Gargano escape, chops down Kross's leg. Hurricane Rana gets caught in the corner, exploded suplex for you. And finally, Cole takes advantage of all this, kicks the leg out of Cross's leg, hits an enziguri, but in the midst of all this, Pete Dunne pulls him out of the ring, puts him between the ring apron and the ring skirt thing, and everyone just attacks him at that point. Later on in the match, Adam Cole basically baits Karrion Kross out onto the ramp. Pete Dunne and Johnny Gargano get involved, and they just throw him through the door of the In Your House set. But it's all temporary stuff. This, they're taking him out to allow them to have little moments between the four of them, which were great in terms of just submission holes being counted into other things or people. Oh, well, I'll get into it anyway. Before all that, Kross keeps just popping back up like the monster you can't put down in a horror movie. He sends O'Reilly and Cole over the barricade. He power bombs Gargano into the ring apron, and then he hoys Dunne onto everyone on the outside. Then it's just Kross and Gargano. Kross hits an F5 for a two count, but Gargano makes a comeback. Tornado DDT via Adam Cole, and he takes out Kyle O'Reilly with a dive. Spear on Kross, diving DDT on Dunne, but he gets super kicked by Adam Cole. He avoids the last shot. Gargano escaped, but Adam Cole fights out. Kross is really angry now. He comes in, hits German suplexes on everyone. Dunne flips out, and that allows everyone to just kick Kross in the head, effectively. And Cole and Kyle O'Reilly have got Kross just hanging on the outside of the ring, and they temporary pausing of what's going on between them and what has been for the last few months to double power bomb Karrion Kross onto the announce desk, which didn't break, which I always love when that happens, especially because he was just sort of splayed out on it, looking like, right, we finally put him down. The four of them get back into the ring. Gargano and Dunne hit stereo super kicks, but then Dunne and O'Reilly have both got submissions and they're looking at each other, and then they get out and they start brawling. Strike exchange between O'Reilly and Gargano. Brainbuster there. He goes up to the top, but Cole takes him out, and Cole hits the Panama Sunrise on Gargano, but Dunne pulls him out of the ring and hits him with a brainbuster. Karrion Kross has recovered in this time. He gets involved, gets in. Pete Dunne, I really like this interaction, and it surprised me. Karrion Kross and Pete Dunne. Karrion Kross gets up. He's fired back up. Pete Dunne shrugs in the center of the ring, offers him in for a fight. They go back and forth again here. Kross hits a German. Dunne hits a German. Dunne hits the bitter end, but Kross kicks out, which was, I didn't really bite again as a title change, but was an enjoyable near fall for me. Oh, my days. This got mad at this point. Karrion Kross puts Pete Dunne in a Kross jacket, but Dunne snaps his fingers to get out of it. Gargano comes in. He hits one final beat on Dunne. Kross puts the Kross jacket on Gargano, but Gargano rolls over, cradles him, but gets a two count. Kross keeps a hold of the hold. Cole comes in, last shot on Kross. He gets taken out by O'Reilly. He hits the diving knee on Kross, but Cole comes back in to break up Kyle O'Reilly's cover on Karrion Kross. Stick with me at the back. We're nearly there. Eventually, O'Reilly dodges the last shot, gets the heel hook on Adam Cole. Looks like Adam Cole's just about to submit. And then in comes Karrion Kross, who grabs Kyle O'Reilly, puts him in the Kross jacket. Kyle O'Reilly refuses to try and escape from the Kross jacket. He just maintains the hold on Cole, hoping, praying that he will submit, but he doesn't. And the lights go out for Kyle O'Reilly. He passes out. He doesn't really let go of the heel hook. He just goes limp. The referee notices this and calls for the stoppage. Karrion Kross retains, submitting, but not really submitting Kyle O'Reilly, just a referee stoppage. Karrion Kross holds the title high and the audience just sort of goes, because that they were crap. But what did you make of this? Well, what it was, Spot Fest.
Elements of it were fantastic. And I thought the storytelling was... some of the beats were inelegant. Mm. They are always going to be when you're doing a match like this, which is why there's fatigue on multi-mans across the board. Like, as you pointed out, the prolonged selling on the outside. It's like, well, how did he get taken out?
Mm.
He'd be scoring near falls at this point, much less selling if it was a normal match and he'd just done that. So it's, you know, the wires are so obvious and it's a little bit alienating. But then again, deeper into the match, like when they... Those four guys, like the four really great wrestlers, putting together sequences and sort of like overlapping with each other. It was just, some of the work was absolutely incredible. Like a PWG style spot fest.
Mm.
But weirdly, like what makes those matches is this absolute white hot crowd, hands stamping on the canvas and just going absolutely ballistic. That wasn't there. So it felt a little bit like deflating in that respect, but some of the work and the creativity were really, really impressive. I did like, if you're going to do something like this, it's that, admire the commitment, even though I don't see the sense in it. But you can't help but say, like, this match was designed to get Karrion Kross over as an absolute unbeatable, invincible warlord.
Mm.
So much so that Kyle O'Reilly and Adam Cole are going to work together, are going to settle their differences, because they realize there is a, if they stand a chance of beating this guy or even subduing him, they have to put those things aside. Like, if nothing else, they are going all in on this Karrion Kross push. But, like, lingering over everything, like a graying cloud, was the idea. Like, I just don't think Karrion Kross is particularly good. So it's like, I describe this as the Wish version of the Royal Rumble 2015 triple threat. It's like the same... Yeah. Like the same kind of storytelling where it's like, right, we've got an invincible monster. We need to team up, get rid of him at any opportunity, and have this ridiculously urgent, rapid sprint to try and just get this match finished as quickly and as creatively before this guy just rises from the depths, like the Lovecraftian horror that he is. That worked magnificently, because when Brock Lesnar did surface, it was like, oh, yeah, he's going to kill him. He's going to kill them. You just don't get that same energy from Kross.
No.
So I admire, there was a lot of detail going into it, and there was a lot of convoluted sequences that were worked incredibly well during the periods where Kross was down. But that whole terrifying feeling of, oh, he's back, you're all doomed, just wasn't there for me, because Karrion Kross isn't.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Some of the actual work in this match bordered on the incredible. I don't think the match was incredible at all. I thought it was very, very good, mostly, apart from the inelegant beats where, as we've said, like you're just on the outside.
Mm.
You're on the outside, and the reason why you're on the outside isn't because you're selling a beating. It's because this is fake.
Mm.
And it's so bad for your investment. Look, it was a very, very, very committed approach to what continues to be a bad idea, and that was putting Karrion Kross over like no one else has been put over on NXT before. I just love the duality of Triple H here, where like he's conflicted. You can see the two sides to him. One, he's a big, massive metalhead. He's everything I kind of wanted to be when I was a babyface. Mm. So let's push him right to the moon. But the other side of him is, I'm kind of trapped now. I've got to give these guys work rate and great actions. That's what I've promised them. So it was them two things, sort of like the positive ends of a magnet or whatever the ones that repel are, like repelling away from each other slightly. It was just, you know, when you have to go to these lengths, when you have to put four super workers and make them put on a super working performance just to give your new guy something approaching a great match expected of NXT, like this match couldn't have crystallized to me anymore the idea of Karrion Kross doesn't work on this brand.
No.
You have to put that much effort to get him in a match that, because Triple H wants those 5 stars. He wants those 4 3/4. And this was his way of getting them on behalf of his new guy, Karrion Kross. And if you happen to go to these lengths to do it, it just ain't working, is it?
Lord knows where you go from this on NXT. And I worry that we're going to get exactly what Michael Hanfler predicted in terms of
even arguably Kyle O'Reilly saying, well, I didn't lose the match. Like everyone else can say, well, I didn't get submitted or pinned. And Kyle O'Reilly can say, well, I didn't submit either. I just sort of passed out and I was kind of busy, if I'm honest. But regardless, we'll see how it goes. Match of the night for you?
Oh, the opener, because it was probably the most fun. There was better work in that main event. You know what? The main event was probably the match of the night, if I'm being
I was umming and ahhing. And then as I was making my notes for this, I realized how long I've probably missed out a load of people's favorite spots from that main event, because I was like, and then this happened and this happened. I was like, I'm going to be talking for like 10 minutes here. So I was, apologies if I rambled on, but I did try and cut it down as much as possible.
It was an incredible job, I thought, Wilborn. I was exhaling and everything.
It was even longer 5 minutes before we came on this podcast. But anyway, that wasn't even the end of the show. It was a surreal end to the show, because there's Karrion Kross. He's holding the title up. You're expecting a little signatures pop him in the corner of the screen. But we cut backstage where William Regal, a sweaty William Regal, is just bloody thankful his night's over, presumably. The interviewer says, well, what do you reckon to take over in your house, Mr. Regal? And he said, well, I've been GM of this brand for 7 years. I've never seen so much bedlam. I think it's time for a change. Michael Sidgwick, could we see William Regal, of all people, leave NXT?
I mean, I guess. Here's the thing. They've applied some thought to all of this. One cynical, one with an idea of, right, okay, well, we need to kind of make a change, maybe. And they've realized that William Regal, and I don't get why he's such a big baby face. I get it. He's a WWE legend in his own way, despite not having that great in-ring run. Enormously respected, like top patter when he wants to be. I can understand how William Regal is received as this really beloved avuncular presence. But I don't think that role is just, who cares? I don't want to see people like getting separated by daddy. I don't want to see daddy lay down the long, hard dick of the law. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to see that kind of dynamic with grown men and women in a wrestling show. I don't see it ever again. So I think people are mourning the idea that William Regal, this is like 200 people on Reddit, like I don't think anyone really cares, mourning the idea that this guy who they like and they are right to like is going away. So the five man wasn't just an excuse to wield a PWG 4.25-star multi-man match next to Karrion Kross to make Karrion Kross look good. The idea of the chaos and the individual confrontations backstage, it's all not just doing that on behalf of Cross, but they're accelerating Regal's exit from here. And it'll be funny. There's been more bedlam in a more like dangerous bedlam in an NXT car park for those 7 years than there has been over the past however many weeks.
Yeah.
Like these are the same tropes with which they build storylines every single week on NXT. It's chaos, it's bedlam, it's Slipknot, it's Poppy, it's Mauro, it's Joseph. Ah! Like bedlam is the brand, and he's now got a problem with it. Like confrontations, car park abductions, the performance center getting like collapsed within itself by Gargano and Ciampa. This is just the norm, isn't it?
I like the idea.
Can't sell this as something that he thinks is out of control.
Or certainly not all of a sudden out of control. Like I like the idea that it gets to like 8 p.m. on a Tuesday and everything's been fine for the rest of the week. And then like Festus, when the bell used to ring, clicks around 8 o'clock, bong, flips the table. Everyone starts punching each other. It's just carnage. And like you say, like, oh, this is the straw that broke the camel's back. A few pull-apart fights between many were going to be fighting each other anyway in half an hour's time. Meanwhile, people getting abducted and, like, nearly dying in the car park as a result of attacks. No, that's fine. That's fine. But I'm fascinated by this because it's an interesting turn of events. Obviously, we're not going to presumably lose William Regal, his backstage influence, because, like you say, he's a legend within WWE. But the early reports were like, maybe it's going to be Samoa Joe. And I was thinking, sorry? Like, I get it. I don't get me wrong. I want to see Samoa Joe back on my TV as soon as possible, wherever that may be. But A, releasing Samoa Joe, and B, then going, actually, let's get him back in a suit. And that's what people really want from him. You know, we don't know his situation in terms of injuries, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think he probably, well, I don't, without question, think would question if he had something to offer this brand. Obviously, he does, especially considering history on there. But it's quite the change from William Regal to a Samoa Joe, potentially.
This is probably a talking point for the TV show preview, which we'll obviously do tomorrow, and you can listen to them wherever you get your podcasts from. But my sense is that it's going to go one of two ways. I think Regal's just going to be gone because they realise that there's an opportunity to do something that he can't do anymore. They could either decide, well, William Regal's beloved and all the rest of it, but like, it's not exactly a draw. Maybe they'll put Michaels or Triple H in that role with the idea of you get to see a veritable WWE legend on this NXT show every week. So that's one direction they can take. Or Samoa Joe kind of makes sense because maybe he can wrestle again at some point, whereas Regal can't. So I reckon they could either put a bigger star who's already there every week in the role of GM, or they can put someone who you think is retired, but it turns out they're not, and they can build to a big GM versus whichever one of the kids is making the most racket match.
All right, we'll keep an eye on that one, and we'll talk more about it, as you said, in the NXT preview podcast tomorrow. But let us know your thoughts on NXT TakeOver in your house on Twitter at WhatCultureWWE. Actually, you can follow both of us. You can follow Michael Sidgwick at
Sidgwick.
Follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE. And make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts. Loads of stuff still coming your way later on today. We're obviously going to have Simon Miller's ups and downs for TakeOver later on. And myself and Sidge are going to be reviewing AEW Dynamite, as well as me and Andy Murray looking ahead to Monday Night Raw tonight. What Culture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for that one. But this has been the NXT TakeOver In Your House review. My thanks to Michael Sidgwick. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.